4. The military briefing droned on toward mid-morning. I suspect that such meetings had shared the same qualities, brisk monotone continuing like a background buzz, the stale taste of too much coffee, the pall of smoke in the air, stacks of hard copy, and the cortical overlay vertigo of implant access, for many centuries. I suspect it was simpler when I was a boy. Wellington rounded up his men, those he dispassionately and accurately called the scum of the earth, told them nothing, and sent them off to die. I brought my attention back to the group. We were in a large room, gray walls relieved by white rectangles of light, gray carpet, gunmetal gray horseshoe table with black disc keys and the occasional carafe of water. CEO Mayna Gladstone sat at the center of the arc of table, ranking senators and cabinet ministers near her, military officers and other second-rank decision-makers farther along the curve. Behind them all, not at the table, sat the inevitable clusters of aides, none of the force people below the rank of colonel, and behind them, on less comfortable-looking chairs, the aides to the aides. I had no chair. With a cluster of other invited but obviously purposeless personnel, I sat on a stool near a rear corner of the room, 20 meters from the CEO and even farther from the briefing officer, a young colonel with a pointer in his hand and no hesitation whatsoever in his voice. Behind the colonel was the gold and gray slab of a Calip template. Before him, the slightly raised omnisphere of the kind found in any hollow pit. From time to time, the Calip clouded and leaped to life. At other times, the air misted with complex hollows. Miniatures of these diagrams glowed on every disc key plate and hovered above some comm logs. I sat on my stool, watched Gladstone, and drew an occasional sketch. Awakening that morning in the Government House guest room, bright Tau Ceti sunlight streaming between peach-colored drapes which had opened automatically at my 06:30 wake-up time, there was a second when I was lost, displaced, still in pursuit of Lenar Hoyt and in fear of the Shrike and Het Mestine. Then, as if some power had granted my wish to leave me to dream my own dreams, there was a minute where confusion compounded and I sat up gasping, looking around in alarm, expecting the lemon carpet and peach-colored light to fade like the fever dream it was, leaving only the pain and phlegm and terrible hemorrhages, blood on linen, the light-filled room dissolving into the shadows of the dark apartment on the Piazza di Spagna, and looming over all, the sensitive face of Joseph Severn leaning forward, watching, and waiting for me to die. I showered twice, first with water and then with Sonic, dressed in a new gray suit that lay set out for me on the just-made bed when I emerged from the bathroom, and set off to find the east courtyard where, a courtesy pip left near my new clothing had told me, breakfast was being served for Government House guests. The orange juice was fresh squeezed. The bacon was crisp and authentic. The newspaper said that CEO Gladstone would be addressing the web via All Thing and media at 10:30 hours web standard. The pages were full of war news. Flat photos of the Armada glowed in full color. General Morpurgo stared out grimly from page 3. The paper called him the hero of the Second Height Rebellion. Diana Philomel glanced over toward me from a nearby table where she dined with her Neanderthal husband. Her gown was more formal this morning, dark blue and far less revealing, but a slit up the side allowed a hint of last night's show. She kept her eyes on me as she lifted a strip of bacon with lacquered nails and took a careful bite. Hermond Philomel grunted as he read something agreeable on the folded financial pages. The Ouster Migration Cluster, commonly known as a swarm, was detected by Hawking distortion-sensing equipment in the CAM system a little more than 3 standard years ago, the young briefing officer was saying. Immediately upon detection, Force Task Force 42, pre-configured for evacuation of Hyperion system, spun up to C-plus status from Parvati with sealed orders to create a Farcaster capability within portal range of Hyperion. At the same time, Task Force 87.2 was dispatched from Salkov Takata staging area around CAM 3 with orders to rendezvous with the evacuation force in Hyperion system, to find the Ouster migration cluster, and to engage and destroy their military components. Images of the armada appeared on the Calip temp in front of the young colonel. He gestured with his pointer, and a line of ruby light cut through the larger hollow to illuminate one of the 3C ships in the formation. Task Force 87.2 is under the command of Admiral Nishita, aboard the HS Hebrides.
"Yes, yes," grumbled General Morpurgo. "We know all this, Yanni. Cut to the quick."
The young colonel simulated a smile, nodded imperceptibly toward the general and CEO Gladstone, and resumed in a voice a trifle less confident.
"Coded fatline transmissions from TF-42 during the past 72 hours, standard, report pitched battles between scouting elements of the evacuation task force and forward elements of the Ouster migration cluster."
"The swarm," interrupted Lee Hunt.
"Yes," said Yanni.
He turned toward the Calip, and 5 meters of frosted glass burned to life. To me, the display was an incomprehensible maze of arcane symbols, colored vector lines, substrate codes, and force acronyms, which added up to total gibberish. Perhaps it made no sense to the big brass and senior politicians in the room either, but no one let on that this was the case. I began a new drawing of Gladstone, with the bulldog profile of Morpurgo in the background.
"Although first reports suggested Hawking Wakes in the neighborhood of 4,000 drives, this is a misleading figure," continued the colonel named Yanni. I wondered whether that was his first or last name. "As you know, Ouster, swarms, can be constituted of up to 10,000 separate drive units, but the vast majority of these are small and either unmanned or of negligible military significance. Microwave, fatline, and other emission signature evaluation suggests..."
"Excuse me," said Mayna Gladstone, her weathered voice in sharp contrast to the briefing officer's syrupy flow. "But could you tell us how many of the Ouster ships are of military significance?"
Said the colonel, and glanced toward his superiors. General Morpurgo cleared his throat.
"We think about 600-700 tops," he said. "Nothing to worry about."
CEO Gladstone raised an eyebrow.
"And the size of our battle groups?"
Morpurgo nodded toward the young colonel to stand at ease. Morpurgo answered,
"Task Force 42 has about 60 ships, CEO. Task Force..."
"Task Force 42 is the evacuation group?" said Gladstone. General Morpurgo nodded, and I thought I saw a hint of condescension in his smile.
"Yes, ma'am. Task Force 87.2, the battle group, which translated in-system about an hour ago, will..."
"Were 60 ships adequate to face 600 or 700? Asked Gladstone. Morpurgo glanced toward one of his fellow officers, as if asking for patience.
"Yes," he said, "more than adequate. You have to understand, CEO, that 600 Hawking drives may sound like a lot, but they're nothing to worry about when they're pushing single ships, or scouts, or one of those little 5-person attack craft they call lancers. Task Force 42 consisted of almost 24 mainline spin ships, including the carriers Olympus Shadow and Neptune Station. Each of these can launch more than 100 fighters or ALRs."
Morpurgo fumbled in his pocket, pulled out a recom smoke stick the size of a cigar, appeared to remember that Gladstone disapproved of them, and struck it back in his coat. He frowned.
"When Task Force 87.2 completes its deployment, we'll have more than enough firepower to deal with 12 swarms."
Still frowning, he nodded toward Yanni to continue. The colonel cleared his throat and gestured with his pointer toward the Calip display.
"As you can see, Task Force 42 had no trouble clearing the necessary volume of space to initiate Farcaster construction. This construction was begun 6 weeks ago, WST, and completed yesterday at 1624 hours standard. Initial Ouster harassing attacks were beaten off with no casualties for TF-42, and during the past 48 hours, a major battle has been waged between advance units of the task force and main Ouster forces. The focus of this skirmish has been here."
Yanni gestured again, and a section of the callop pulsed with blue light beyond the tip of his pointer.
29 degrees above the plane of the ecliptic. 30 AU from Hyperion's sun, approximately 0.35 AU from the hypothetical rim of the system's Oort cloud.
Casualties? Said Lee Hunt.
Quite within acceptable limits for a firefight of this duration, said the young colonel, who looked like he had never been within a light year of hostile fire. His blonde hair was carefully combed to the side and gleamed under the intense glow of the spots. 26 hegemony fast attack fighters destroyed or missing, 12 torpedo-carrying ALRs, 3 torch ships, the fuel transport Asquith's Pride, and the cruiser Draconi III.
How many people lost? Asked CEO Gladstone. Her voice was very quiet.
Yanni glanced quickly at Mor Pergo, but answered the question himself. Around 2,300, he said. But rescue operations are currently being carried out, and there is some hope of finding survivors of the Draconi.
He smoothed his tunic and went on quickly.
This should be weighed against confirmed kills of at least 150 ouster warships. Our own raids into the migration cluster, the Swarm, have resulted in an additional 30 to 60 destroyed craft, including comet farms, ore processing ships, and at least one command cluster.
Mayna Gladstone rubbed her gnarled fingers together. Did the casualty estimates, our casualties, include the passengers and crew of the destroyed tree ship Yggdrasil, which we had chartered for the evacuation?
No, ma'am, Yanni responded briskly. Although there was an ouster raid in progress at the time, our analysis shows that the Yggdrasil was not destroyed by enemy action.
Gladstone again raised an eyebrow.
What then? Sabotage, as far as we can tell at this time, said the colonel. He prompted another Hyperion system diagram onto the callop.
General Mor Pergo glanced at his comm log and said,
Skip to the ground defenses, Yanni. The CEO has to deliver her speech in 30 minutes.
I completed the sketch of Gladstone and Mor Pergo, stretched, and looked around for another subject. Lee Hunt seemed a challenge, with his nondescript, almost pinched features. When I glanced back up, a hollowed globe of Hyperion ceased spinning and unwound itself into a series of flattened projections, oblique equirectangular, Bonn, orthographic, rosette, Van der Grinten, Gores, interrupted good homolocene, mnemonic, sinusoidal, azimuthal equidistant, polyconic, hypercorrected Kuatsi, computer Eschered, Breismeister, Buckminster, Miller cylindrical, multi-collographed, and Satplot standard, before resolving into a standard Robinson-Baird map of Hyperion. I smiled. That had been the most enjoyable thing I had seen since the briefing began. Several of Gladstone's people were shifting with impatience. They wanted at least 10 minutes with the CEO before the broadcast began.
As you know, began the colonel, Hyperion is Old Earth standard to 9.89 on the Theron-Laumier scale of...
Oh, for Christ's sakes, growled Mor Pergo. Get to the troop dispositions and get it over with.
Yes, sir.
Yanni swallowed and lifted his pointer. His voice was no longer confident.
As you know, I mean...
He pointed to the northernmost continent, floating like a poorly done sketch of a horse's head and neck, terminating jaggedly where the beast's chest and back muscles would begin.
This is Equus. It has a different official name, but everyone's called it that since... This is Equus. The chain of islands running southeast... Here and here is called the Cat and Nine Tails. Actually, it's an archipelago with more than 100. Anyway, the second major continent is called Aquila, and perhaps you can see it's shaped something like an old Earth eagle with the beak here, on the northwest coast, and the talons extended here to the southwest, and at least one wing raised here running to the northeast coast. This section is the so-called Pinion Plateau, and is almost inaccessible due to the flame forests, but here, and here, to the southwest are the main fiber-plastic plantations.
The disposition of troops, growled Mor Pergo.
I sketched Yanni. I discovered that it is impossible to convey the sheen of sweat with graphite.
Yes, sir. The third continent is Ursus. Looks a bit like a bear. But no force troops landed there because it's south polar, almost uninhabitable, although the Hyperion Self-Defense Force keeps a listening post there. Yanni seemed to sense he was babbling. He drew himself up, wiped his upper lip with the back of his hand, and continued in a more composed tone. Primary force ground installations here, here, and here. His pointer illuminated areas near the capital of Keats, high on the neck of Equus. Force space units have secured the primary spaceport at the capital, as well as secondary fields here and here. He touched the cities of Endymion and Port Romance, both on the continent of Aquila. Force ground units have prepared defensive installations here. 2 dozen red lights winked on, most on the neck and main areas of Equus, but several in Aquila's Beak and Port Romance regions. These include elements of the Marines, as well as ground defenses, ground-to-air and ground-to-space components. High Command expects that, unlike Brescia, there will be no battles on the planet itself, but should they attempt an invasion, we will be ready for them. Mayna Gladstone checked her comm log. 17 minutes remained until her live broadcast. What about evacuation plans? Yanni's regained composure crumbled. He looked in some desperation toward his superior officers.
No evacuation, said Admiral Singh. It was a feint, a lure for the ousters.
Gladstone tapped her fingers together.
There are several million people on Hyperion, Admiral.
Yes, said Singh, and we'll protect them. But an evacuation of even the 60,000 or so hegemony citizens is quite out of the question. It would be chaos if we allowed all 3 million into the web. Besides, for security reasons, it is not possible.
The Shrike? Queried Lee Hunt.
Security reasons, repeated General Morpurgo.
He stood up, took the pointer from Yanni. The young man stood there for a second, irresolute, seeing no place to sit or stand, and then he moved to the rear of the room, near me, stood at parade rest, and stared at something near the ceiling, possibly the end of his military career.
Task Force 87.2 is in system, said Morpurgo. The ousters have pulled back to their swarm center, about 60 AU from Hyperion. To all intents and purposes, the system is secure. Hyperion is secure. We're waiting for a counterattack, but we know that we can contain it. Again, to all intents and purposes, Hyperion is now part of the web. Questions?
There were none. Gladstone left with Lee Hunt, a pack of senators, and her aides. The military brass gravitated to huddles, apparently as dictated by rank. Aides scattered. The few reporters allowed in the room ran to their imager crews waiting outside. The young colonel, Yanni, remained at parade rest, his eyes unfocused, his face very pale. I sat for a moment, staring at the call-up map of Hyperion. The continent Equus's resemblance to a horse was greater at this distance. From where I sat, I could just make out the mountains of the Bridal Range and the orange-yellow coloring of the high desert below the horse's eye. There were no force defensive positions marked northeast of the mountains, no symbols at all besides a tiny red glow, which might have been the dead city of poets. The time tombs were not marked at all. It was as if the tombs had no military significance, no part to play in the day's proceedings. But somehow, I knew better. Somehow, I suspected that the entire war, the movement of thousands, the fate of millions, perhaps billions, depended upon the actions of 6 people in that unmarked stretch of orange and yellow. I folded my sketchbook, stuffed my pencils in pockets, looked for an exit, found and used it. Lee Hunt met me in one of the long hallways that led to the main entrance.
You are leaving?
I took a breath. Aren't I allowed to? Hunt smiled. If one could call that upward folding of thin lips a smile.
Of course, M. Severn. But CEO Gladstone has asked me to tell you that she would like to speak to you again this afternoon.
When? Hunt shrugged.
Any time after her speech. At your convenience.
I nodded. Literally, millions of lobbyists, job seekers, would-be biographers,
business people, fans of the CEO, and potential assassins would give almost anything to have a minute with the hegemony's most visible leader. A few seconds with CEO Gladstone. And I could see her, at my convenience.
No one ever said the universe was sane.
I brushed past Lee Hunt and made for the front door. By long tradition, Government House had no public Farcaster portals within its walls. It was a short walk past the main entrance security baffles, across the garden, to the low, white building that served as press headquarters and Terminex. The news steeps were clustered around a central viewing pit, where the familiar face and voice of Llewellyn Drake,
the voice of all thing,
gave background to CEO Gladstone's speech,
of vital importance to the hegemony.
I nodded in his direction, found an unused portal, presented my universal card, and went in search of a bar. The Grand Concourse was, once you got there, the one place in the web where you could forecast for free. Every world in the web had offered at least one of its finest urban blocks. TC Squared provided 23 blocks for shopping, entertainment, fine restaurants, and bars. Especially bars. Like River Tethys, the Grand Concourse flowed between military-sized Farcaster portals 200 meters high. With wraparound, the effect was of an infinite main street, a 100-kilometer torus of material delights. One could stand, as I did that morning, under the brilliant sun of Tau Ceti, and look down the concourse to the nighttime midway of Deneb Dre, alive with neon and hollows, and catch a glimpse of the 100-tiered main mall of Lussis, while knowing that beyond it lay the shadow-dappled boutiques of God's Grove, with its brick concourse and elevators to treetops, the most expensive eatery in the web. I didn't give a damn about all that. I just wanted to find a quiet bar. TC Squared bars were too filled with bureaucrats, teeps, and business types, so I caught one of the concourse shuttles and stepped off on Sol Draconi Septim's main drag. The gravity discouraged many. It discouraged me, but it meant that the bars were less full, and those there had come to drink. The place I chose was a ground-level bar, almost hidden under the support pillars and service chutes to the main shopping trellis. And it was dark inside. Dark walls, dark wood, dark patrons. Their skin as black as mine was pale. It was a good place to drink, and I did so, starting with a double scotch and getting more serious as I went along. Even there I couldn't be free of Gladstone. Far across the room, a flat-screen TV showed the CEO's face with the blue and gold background she used for state broadcasts. Several of the other drinkers had gathered to watch. I heard snatches of the speech.
To ensure the safety of hegemony citizens and cannot be allowed to endanger the safety of the web or our allies in thus I have authorized a full military response to turn that goddamn thing down.
I was amazed to realize that it was me shouting. The patrons glowered over their shoulders, but they turned it down. I watched Gladstone's mouth move a moment, and then I waved to the bartender for another double. Sometime later, it might have been hours, I looked up from my drink to realize that there was someone sitting across from me in the dark booth. It took me a second, blinking, to realize who it was in the dim light. For an instant, my heart raced as I thought, Fanny, but then I blinked again and said, Lady Philomel. She still wore the dark blue dress I'd seen her in at breakfast. Somehow it seemed cut lower now. Her face and shoulders seemed to glow in the near darkness. M. Severn, she said, her voice almost a whisper. I've come to redeem your promise. Promise? I waved the bartender over, but he did not respond. I frowned and looked at Diana Philomel. What promise? To draw me, of course. Did you forget your promise at the party? I snapped my fingers, but the insolent barkeep still did not deign to look my way. I did draw you, I said. Yes, said Lady Philomel, but not all of me. I sighed and drained the last of my scotch. Drinking, I said. Lady Philomel smiled. So I see, I started to stand to go after the bartender, thought better of it, and sat back slowly onto the weathered wood of the bench. "Armageddon," I said. "They're playing with Armageddon." I looked at the woman carefully, squinting slightly to bring her into focus.
"Do you know that word, m'lady?"
"I don't believe he will serve you any more alcohol," she said. "I have drinks at my place. You could have one while you draw." I squinted again, craftily now. I might have had a few too many scotches, but they hadn't impaired my awareness. "Husband," I said. Diana Philomel smiled again, and that too was radiant. "Spending several days at Government House," she said, truly whispering now. "He can't be far from the source of power at such an important time. Come, my vehicle is just outside." I don't remember paying, but I assume I did. Or Lady Philomel did. I don't remember her helping me outside, but I assume that someone did. Perhaps a chauffeur. I remember a man in gray tunic and trousers, remember leaning against him. The EMV had a bubble top, polarized from the outside but quite transparent from where we sat in deep cushions and looked out. I counted one, two portals, and then we were out and away from the concourse and gaining altitude above blue fields under a yellow sky. Elaborate homes, made from some ebony wood, sat on hilltops surrounded by poppy fields and bronze lakes. Renaissance vector? It was too difficult a puzzle to work on right then. So I laid my head against the bubble and decided to rest for a moment or two. Had to be rested for Lady Philomel's portrait. Heh heh. The countryside passed below.